comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet, thank you for being here. It's talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and it is the show where you matter. This is K-Files night. That means that immediately following the show tonight, we start sending out our newsletter. Are you subscribed? Well, if you're not, why not? I mean, you got to ask yourself, where's the genius in this decision? If you're not subscribed to our newsletter, it's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and there are no strings attached, really. So, and it's a good newsletter, so there's really no genius in not being subscribed. Now, to subscribe, you just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click the link that says K-Files. You'll see it. It's the largest link on the page. Right, staring you right in the face when you open up the page. It's right in the middle of the screen. And it'll take you about 10 seconds, 20 seconds, something like that, to subscribe. It's fast. What do you think about mind control? What do you think the powers that be may be doing in the realm of mind control? Well, it's a kind of a spooky topic. It's the sort of thing, I think, that gets all of our engines revved up because we don't want people messing around with our minds. As feeble as our own thoughts may be deemed by some, we still want them to be our own thoughts. We don't want our minds being controlled and invaded by anyone. And that would include people using technology to do it. So, it's the kind of thing that when we talk about it, people get pretty excited, because it's understandable, because none of us want to be messed with. We want to be our own selves as much as that is possible. We want to be our own individual self. So when we start talking about mind control, people feel uneasy sometimes. I do. Well, the guy who's going to be our guest tonight and who's going to speak to us tonight is truly one of the Earth's experts, a real expert, not the pseudo kind. In these high technology devices that could be used in some cases for some really good purposes, but could also be used against us as mind control devices. His name is Dr. Nick Begich. Dr. Nick Begich is the one of the co-authors of Angels Don't Play This Harp, and you're familiar with that book. It's been out for a while, and it's a classic. He's also got some books about mind control devices. We're going to hear from him in just a moment. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said before we went to break, we're privileged tonight to have Dr. Nick Begich with us on the show. It's been some time since he's been with us, though he has been here before a couple of times. And it's always interesting and it's always a pleasure for me to be able to say, welcome to the show. Dr. Begich, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show once again.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you always this evening.
All the way from Canada, Alaska. Now, you guys are just about to enter into, nighttime or daytime there?
Nighttime, yeah, that's exactly it. Fall is pretty much over for us, and we're getting a little bit of dusting up on the mountains above where I live, a little snow, and should be down here within the next couple of weeks at my elevation. I'm a couple hundred feet above sea level here, just north of Anchorage. And so fall's over. It only lasts a few weeks, and we're headed into winter and the darker time of the year. I think we're losing about six minutes of daylight a day, so it starts to rack up pretty fast here.
I've been all over the world, but I've never been to Alaska. I hear you can see Russia from there, but I've never been there.
Well, so, some people think so.
Well, that's what I've heard. I've never been there, but I've heard that.
In the sense that we are.
Okay, now, but just a quick question, and then we'll get into what I really want to talk to you about. But at this time of the year in Alaska, when you're headed into the darker time of the year, does it really get to be like nighttime 24 hours a day?
Well, where I am, not so much. I mean, but Alaska's a big place. I mean, I'm in South Central Alaska. Here in the worst of this darkness, the sun will set around 2:30 in the afternoon and rise, pretty late in the morning. You end up with about, I think, 6 hours, somewhere less than 6 hours in the worst part. But up north now, when you get above, here from Anchorage to, say, Prudhoe Bay, which is on the top of the state, it's about a 700-mile distance, so there's quite a bit of distance there. And in that case, the sun will actually set, and it won't be seen again for pretty much, I think it's about 45 or 50 days, something like this. But it's quite a long time. I mean, you get this kind of twilight when the sun gets close to the horizon, but basically it's nighttime. And that's, for people that aren't used to that kind of condition, it can be pretty severe in terms of vitamin D depletion over long periods of time, and eventually catches up with you.
A lot of people have no idea really how big Alaska is. It's roughly one-fifth the size. It one-fifth of the United States. You put it inside the continental United States and it'll cover a fifth of it.
And that's just the land mass. If you look at the coastline of Alaska and you look at it on a map to scale, it's actually the coastline, which includes a 200-mile U.S. federal limit, is longer than the West Coast, Gulf Coast, and East Coast combined. So when you think about Alaska in terms of not just landmass, but offshore resources, Alaska is huge. In fact, we're the largest and last of the great fisheries in the world. We have, in Arctic waters, 25% of all of the undiscovered petroleum hydrocarbons are expected to be found in the world in the Arctic. A lot of resource in terms of minerals for the United States, and potential, actually, for even doing some pretty remarkable things in terms of our economy. If we would ever look at Alaska a little bit differently, instead of the place where Sarah Palin comes from, where we can see Russia from here, really, Alaska's really a great hope for the whole country. And I'll give you a couple examples of why. We have, in natural resources here, if we were linked by a rail system, which many people don't realize it, but we have no real linkages coming out of Alaska, and yet we have the potential to provide petroleum resources, natural gas resources, petrochemicals, and build entire industries if we were just linked to the Trans-Canadian Railroad, which is, of course, linked to the U.S. Lower 48 rail systems. And if you look at Alaska in terms of infrastructure, just the infrastructure projects alone open up 20% of the country in terms of land mass, and 70% of Alaska's federal lands, which represents half of all federal lands in the country. And so when you think about it in terms of national resources, Alaska offers an incredible hope in the sense that we have, as the economy has totally collapsed in the lower 48 states, Alaska housing prices are stable, our unemployment is a little bit less than the rest of the country, which is unusual, and the industries that are on the drawing boards for expansion here are enormous, and it's because of natural raw resources. The sad story is all of them, if not most of them, will end up being exported into the Pacific Rim, Asia, Japan, for value-added, where a lot of value-added could be still done in the United States. And that's a sad story, because it's not just raw goods. I mean, we're almost like a third-world country up here, but we're part of the United States, and the United States has failed to access the national treasury, not in the form of a taxpayer's wallet, but in the form of national resources that could stimulate tremendous economic activity.
Well, let's talk about some of the federal land up there. We'll just kick it off with something that really, it's been a number of years that you have been, you wrote about HAARP, you've lectured on HAARP, you've testified about HAARP, and I guess maybe you get tired of HAARP. But I'll tell you something, HAARP is something.
Well, you know, it never seems the issue just won't go away, and you know it continues to gain, you know, a currency around the world, and people are becoming increasingly aware of, you know, of what this technology represents, and the fact that, you know, really it's just a small part of a number of advances in technology, and I think that's probably maybe even more important these days, is that we look more broadly than HAARP, and we start thinking about, you know, the implications of environmental manipulation to systems like this, but recognizing there are other ways to do similar things, and the technologies that are possible with HAARP, there's other things that are equally as disconcerting. And I think that's maybe the challenge, and the bigger challenge of the century is, you know, figuring out how to live compatibly with advanced technologies and not destroy ourselves or totally wipe out the cognitive memory of what freedom and liberty should be about. So I think those are, you know, obviously big challenges, and technology is sort of on the backdrop of that. But ultimately, you know, it's about, you know, what we're going to decide in terms of our value systems, and whether we're going to continue to fall in the traps that we've fallen in the past, or start to sort of reassess.
Well, let me ask you a question, because
certainly in technology, we've always been a leader in innovation, in technology, raw resource production. We were a leader for many, many decades, and we can reclaim a portion of that path and start to take greater control of our national destiny. You know, ultimately, you know, when you think about imports and exports, half of it is related to energy resources, which I'm convinced, both through alternatives and traditional means, we could be self-sufficient. That's half of our trade balance. The other is exports and import balances primarily with China. And although, you know, that's a more difficult thing to overcome, the innovation possibilities and at least some value added with our raw resources offers some additional opportunities I think we're missing in the U.S. But, you know, these are all things that in the long run, you know, they generate jobs, taxes, more balanced budgets. I mean, economic...
Can you see China from Alaska? Can you see China from Alaska?
Right. Say that again. I'm having a little trouble.
Can you see China from Alaska?
I'll tell you, they're one of our biggest trading partners. Kind of interesting. You know, Alaska is a net exporter based on the fact that we export a lot of raw materials both to mainland China and Taiwan. Can't see it from here, but I can tell you, you know, when you look again at a world map, that the freight transit system through Alaska, Chinese freight is transited through Alaska, and a lot, and more recently, some of that freight actually has been rerouted. We don't have adequate supplies of jet fuel available here. And I mean, there's some things happening on that to make jet fuel more available by producing some locally.
That's a good thing if you produce jet fuel locally. But if you produce jet fuel locally, you won't be buying it from overseas, and that will affect the balance of trade again, won't it?
Right, and at the same time, there's actually a couple of projects. One of them I'll be involved in next week, and it's a Senate hearing in our state legislature here during the interim. I'm having a hearing on a coal to liquids a concept, which has been done by a number of companies around the world. And essentially what they do is they convert coal into JPA fuel, and it's considered a biofuel because of its environmental considerations, as both it's being processed and in terms of emissions and the byproduct as well as the quality of the fuel. And the interesting thing is the cost of production is so competitive that by having an abundant supply of jet fuel in our region, not only we supply our immediate needs, which is about 60,000 barrels a day because of the amount of cargo, air freight cargo coming through Anchorage, if we had an increasing or more stable supply, that would allow us to be a net exporter of jet fuel, not just for our own needs, but actually the Air Force has a requirement for biofuels, 50% biofuels, I think by the year 2016, and the project slated for potentially the west side of Cook Inlet here in Alaska may in fact supply a portion of that. And that's those kinds of concepts, and again, instead of importing fuels from other places, we're able to create industries right here at home and perhaps be a net exporter as well. And those are exciting things, I think, in terms of what Alaska has to offer the rest of the country.
All right, I want to get back to HAARP, sort of. I don't, we've talked about HAARP a lot, and we've read about HAARP a lot, and I really don't want to harp on HAARP. But I got a couple of questions about it. For one thing, we hear that it's a baby, and that there's a bigger installation that we never hear about, and that it also is in Alaska. And after I finish setting this up, if you will, comment on that if you know about it. But here's the deal. The deal is, when you fire up the HAARP-type transmitters, and it certainly is not the only one, there are several of these around the world, when you fire these up,
right.
It would seem to me that they're powerful enough to disrupt the Earth's own natural force fields and rhythms. Do you have any information about that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. In fact, one of the things that they're designed to do is create a pulsed signal into the ionosphere, which is, responsible for the character and quality of wireless communications, all over the world. In fact, including in some instances during extreme solar activities where the ionosphere is disturbed, you can get even interference with power grids, electrical systems of all kinds, not just broadcast systems. The thing about HAARP is it creates a modulation. You can send energy in and literally pump it into the ionosphere, changing its character in such a way as literally you literally send a signal back to the Earth that can be then manipulated for a bunch of different applications, whether they be straight military sort of applications or coupling events where you can literally couple to the Earth in a way that creates a different kind of an event. In fact, Eastland, the inventor, believed that you could manipulate gravitational waves with HAARP, which he felt, based on theoretical models, that would then have a tremendous downstream effect, not just on weather systems, but perhaps being able to manipulate complete geophysical systems just by using instruments like HAARP, as if you're tuning the planet or finding those unique instabilities that you can trigger with this type of resonant energy. And that's essentially what a lot of the research has been about. How do you create a resonance effect using a pulsed radio frequency signal to cause changes in gravitational waves or changes in weather systems, etc.
In other words, how do you cause earthquakes and volcanoes?
Yeah, I mean, this idea is not new. There's actually Defense Secretary Cohen, he was in office. Back in 97 at the University of Georgia, he was speaking with Senators Lugar and Nunn in a conference on international terrorism. Now, this is 4 years before the 9/11 event. And what they said at that time, and I'm paraphrasing just a bit, but in a DOD news briefing shortly after, he was talking about this whole capability of triggering these kinds of events. And as we're talking, I'm going to try and find the exact quote, because it's pretty profound. And what he said, you know, in talking about, you know, sort of advanced technologies, was that we would have, and that we do have, this capability by manipulating electromagnetic waves. We can trigger earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, climate change. And these are the very things he was referencing there were, in fact, the issues of HAARP. And it was in the DOD news briefing, you can look it up. It was April 21st, 1997, and it was University of Georgia. But you should be able to find it pretty easy on the web. Those things are out there, and it's actually quoted in my book, Earth Rising, the Revolution, and the citation is there.
All right. Now, here's well, let me ask you this. Do you know anything? I mean, we're hearing rumors that HAARP is a baby and there's a bigger one somewhere in Alaska. Do you know anything about that?
I've not heard that, and I would have to see the evidence of it. You know, these things tend to, there tends to be a lot of misinformation along the line, but I would like to see that, and if somebody can give me some coordinates, we can certainly find out. So that would be useful. And people can do that. You know, if somebody has that kind of information, wants to communicate it to us, you know, we'll look into it. We're on the web. We're pretty easy to find. And just shoot us an email at earthpulse.com, and we'll look into it, because we certainly would be interested in seeing that.
All right. Now, here's really what I wanted to ask you about HAARP. Because, you know, most of the geophysical stuff, we're all pretty much up to speed on that now. I mean, we weren't, but we are now, thanks to you and a couple of other people that have written about HAARP and done some things about HAARP. But one of the things, you know, I've read several of your books, and I attended one of your seminars. And in the seminar, you gave a demonstration of some mind control devices, and you talked about various experiments that have been done in various nations relative to mind control.
Right.
All right, now, we have a break taking over. When we come back from this break, I want to ask you about HAARP relative to mind control. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Nick Begich. Dr. Begich, as we went away to break, I said, I want to ask you a question about HAARP relative to mind control. If HAARP is energizing things such as the ionosphere, is it possible that it has, if not mind control, does it have a possible side effect of affecting the psyche, the psychology of people on the ground where this reflected energy comes down?
Well, you know, this is a really important point. You know, the idea that an external oscillating field might be able to influence human behavior is really not new. The idea that radio frequency energy, the stuff of HAARP, could also do this with a pulsed electromagnetic signal is not new either. In fact, you can go back to 1985 at Yale University, Jose Delgado had done some experiments with pulsed electromagnetic fields using energy concentrations 1/50th of the concentration or density of the Earth's natural magnetic fields. And because he hit very specific window frequencies where there was a biological effect, he was able to change the emotional state of primates and humans from lethargic and passive to highly active just using a pulsed radio frequency signal. That's a pretty profound approach. In fact, on another vein, another gentleman using a wireless system actually transferred sound information, just like people are hearing our voice today, wirelessly transferring sound information where the brain could then reinterpret it, you know, as that proverbial voice in the head. Now, that was with a directed technology using acoustics, whereas HARP is using radio frequency energy. The idea of moving the emotional state of a human being on a large scale over a large geographic area is indeed possible with HARP. And the fact is, we did separate research on this whole issue of mind control and sort of the underlying mechanism for what causes those biological effects, and then some of the history of sort of how that technology evolved, you know, not just including our comments on HARP, but more broadly than that. And the book, Controlling the Human Mind, which was the last book that I authored, really gets into that issue. Over 250 reference sources showing clearly the evolution of technology in the United States from the very discoveries of hypnosis in the 1880s in terms of its real effect, where it started to get studied academically much more vigorously, and all the way through the research at Harvard and starting in the 20s and rolling up through the 1960s. And then going beyond that, you know, there's a lot that has been done in a number of fields. HARP was even thought of years ago, 1969, when J.F. Gordon MacDonald was commenting on technologies for manipulating human behavior, and he said, you know, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere just the right way, which is what HARP can now do, we could manipulate the behavior of people over huge geographic areas. And J.F. Gordon MacDonald was a full professor of geophysics at UCLA, and he was also a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson when he was president. And he made that statement in 1969. So, it's, you know, this stuff's been around a very long time. HARP happens to be sort of the ultimate delivery system if you want to affect things on a hemisphere. So.
Are you familiar with, I'm sure you are, the work of the Russian scientist Smirnov in the field of psychotronics? And
right. In fact, Smirnov appeared in a documentary with me and a number of other people that was done by CBC TV, Canadian Public Broadcasting, in a program called Undercurrents. And it was back, I believe he passed away a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Before he passed away, we did this segment, and he demonstrated, you know, his techniques, which were a variety of things, actually. But he was able to mask a signal that he could pipe up to street levels and actually influence people both within the office complex he was in, as well as people on the street, workmen on the street, to behave in a certain way. And in one instance, a demonstration was done where they put out the signal, you know, bring us cake, and a pretty traditional thing, and at a break time you might eat these small little cakes, but the workmen outside, the people in the building, inexplicably to them, were doing in fact that. And so, you know, one small example of what you can do, and Smirnov, one of the leaders, he also had an FBI interface during Waco. At one time the FBI denied any working relationship, they acknowledged it, and Smirnov acknowledged it. And what exactly they did, Smirnov said, unfortunately, they acted too rapidly. If they had just taken a little more time, that thing could have been brought under control. Now the question is, you know, could we? Apparently so, and should we? You know, that's the real question. Should we deploy weapons that manipulate human behavior? And if so, under what conditions? And if not, why not? We need to think that through, because, you know, this is the very essence of our individual liberty. You know, the idea to think freely presupposes you know, everything else that we consider liberating or free in a civil society. So, you know, the new technologies offer unique challenges as well, and a great deal of responsibility for those of us funding this work, which is every American citizen.
Well, Smirnoff's widow has continued and expanded on his work. She has continued his work at the Institute. The Institute is called the Psychotechnology Research Institute. It is in Moscow, and her name is Elena Rusalkina. What's interesting to me about their work, her work is an extension of his work. What's interesting is that in 2007, the Department of Homeland Security got very, very interested in this. They were, although I do not know if they ever actually did a contract with Elena Rusalkina and the Institute, they were in the, they were going through all the phases of what they have to do a contract, a single source contract. And the reason is because her work claims that you simply transmit certain sounds, and then her sensors and computers can detect who in the crowd is a likely terrorist. So the Department of Homeland Security was going to do this single source contract and then experiment with this in airports and see how well it worked. Well, for some people that may sound like a wonderful thing. Certainly, if we knew that someone was planning a terrorist attack, then it would be good to isolate that person and prevent them from getting on the airplane or whatever, if we knew for sure that's what was going to happen. But based on this technology, what if you're walking through the airport, they're playing these sounds, and you happen to be a special effects producer for a movie company, and you're thinking about that next movie that you're flying out to work on, and it's an action movie, and it's got a scene with a hijacking, and you're thinking about staging the hijacking. Now, if this technology actually works and it identifies that guy, is he subject to losing his freedom over thinking about a hijacking that's fictional but still thinking about it simply because this machine read his mind?
Well, you know, this is interesting because they also let a contract for a similar type of project for the University of California. Now, it's actually a couple of contracts. One was for looking at the brain to start to map out, you know, sort of what signals the brain produces that are associated with clear and precise thoughts and visual images, for sort of building an index that they could, you know, lay over a large population and be, you know, be accurate. And secondly, the idea was to figure out ways to create what they called electronic telepathy, not only extract information from somebody, but also put information in, both for controlling the direction of your own movements and for screwing around with your enemy. So, yeah, this doesn't surprise me one bit. In fact, there's, on a crude level, you know, one of the things they did early on is, right after 9/11, Signal Intelligence published an article that talked about the idea of using devices similar to, would be an appearance similar to metal detectors, but you would pass through and it would catch anyone who was in an unusually agitated state. In other words, you just pick up kind of a gross nervousness. But, you know, a lot of people are nervous flying anyway, and their idea was, well, this would segregate, you know, sort of from the herd, you know, those that need to be checked more closely. And then when you start to look at the newer sort of advances in the technology, and the advances come along with computer processing capacities and the combination of nanotechnologies, information processing, and a variety of other technologies are emerging at a pretty rapid rate, giving us the ability to do this with a higher and higher and higher level of resolution. So we get from the point of just sort of analyzing gross emotions to the point of not only analyzing, but projecting and dissecting specific thoughts and understanding them. Now, the issue is, just because you think something doesn't mean you're going to do it. In fact, that's called your conscience, which sort of works with you and wrestles with you. And we all do that internally as we're little children all the way through adulthood. And, you know, we reconcile things internally as we sort of map out what our choices are. But to have that monitored by a third party, I don't think so. I think that's what we do is what matters. What we think is truly our domain of freedom. And I think when we start to cross those thresholds, we better tread lightly, because freedom and the loss of it is just a breath away.
Well, if Department of Homeland Security actually has this technology now, then we have crossed that line.
Yeah, I would say at some level, yeah, absolutely. And you know, and here's the thing is, I pretty much quit lecturing with very rare exception a few years ago. And primarily because I don't like going through the airports anymore. And I don't like having to compromise my view of freedom to the extent that I do in a U.S. airport, which in my opinion, as I look at the nature of security in the U.S. versus the nature of security, for instance, in Europe before 9/11, and the nature of security in the U.S. after 9/11, I would rather be in Europe, where there really is security, because what I see at airports in the United States is an illusion. And the fact of the matter is, if it wasn't for, the problem is we, on the one hand, have become reliant, particularly during the Bush administration, and although nothing's been done, and I don't expect it will be.
No, actually, more have been lost and more are slated for loss.
And when you think about it, here's one other aspect of all this. You know, all communications is being monitored at some level, and all of your foreign communication is being monitored and logged and stored. And so here's the thing that happens is, you know, okay, they don't have a warrant to go digging through your voice traffic today, but tomorrow, you know, or the next day, maybe this country becomes like it was or like it might be, you know. And so leadership you got today is not necessarily leadership you got tomorrow. The difference is the amount of data stored on you and available for analysis is just unprecedented. Your idea of personal privacy and my idea of personal privacy is so altered from the notion that it sort of began and ended with your front door or your house. Personal privacy begins with your digital doorway at an unprecedented level. More information is stored electronically about people than any time in our history, and the volume is continuing to grow, and the ability to hack and extract information is continuing to grow. And at some point in the advancement of technologies comes the next great breakthrough in computing, which is computing in terms of quantum computing.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Indeed, listening to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Nick Begich. Dr. Begich, you were talking about you didn't like the having to go through all the security stuff at the airport, and you know, I agree with you. I've traveled in just about every part of the world, and granted, in some places security is a joke. They just don't have it in some places. In some places, they have excellent security, but I have yet to see excellent security here. I see a lot of stuff that looks like security, it really, really isn't. It, you know, it looks like it to those who don't know what they're looking at, but it really isn't very effective. And I can't pass this opportunity to say, the last time I flew out of Phoenix, They did. I get the full tilt boogie every time I fly, and so they put me through the full body X-ray, and then this guy, who I think is probably the poster child for lobotomies, says, "Mr. Smith, are you wearing briefs or boxers?" Can you imagine that? Are you wearing briefs or boxers? I said, "Well, you just took a full body X-ray. What did you see?"
You know, it's it's a whole. It just has desensitized people to what their expectations are. You know, I think that's part of it. You know, and it's always this struggle between what's the acceptable level of safety and security against what some think is just the notion of freedom. You know, and to me, it's a little more serious than that. But you know, it is the challenge, really, of this the beginning of this century is how do we maintain a balance between our technologies, our personal security, our liberty, and more importantly, what does that do to the potential for human expression and consciousness itself? I mean, who sets the norm for what's appropriate thought? You know, that's going to be a really interesting challenge. The other thing that's coming in some of this research, the Air Force has a project where they're looking to create entirely synthetic memory sets where they get the full spread of sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, all of those kinds of sensations transferred into the brain in such a way that you actually believe you experienced what is really synthetic. Now think about that. You know, it's kind of, you know, sounds pretty sci-fi today, but it was in the June 2004, it was their cover story in Technology Horizons, which is put out by the Air Force Research Lab, and the article is called Controlled Effects. Now, within that, they talk about this. Now, think about that in terms of 30 years off into the future, you're sitting in a jury box listening to testimony of someone who swears to God that they just saw what they saw, and how would we really know if this technology emerges as it's being planned and funded today?
Well, you said it sounds pretty sci-fi.
You know, who controls the latest technology really manipulates way too much.
You said it sounds sci-fi, and in fact it may be, because this Dr. Smirnov's technology came to the attention of the FBI, and it came to the attention of Department of Homeland Security via two former science fiction writers turned Pentagon consultants, Chris and Janet Morris.
Yep.
Now, Chris and Janet Morris.
Yeah, now that doesn't surprise me at all. In fact, they were in the same documentary with Smirnov.
Mm-hmm. Well, they
and
what happened?
When you start to look at some of the more exotic sort of think tanks, in the past, they used to spin them off into fun organizations where they'd run them through central intelligence or military intelligence, and they still run them quite a bit through DARPA. In fact, there's a lot of material on the DARPA-related projects. I have some of it posted under the Mind Effects section of EarthPulse.com, and you can check out some of that. You'll also see some of the latest Navy protocol on human experiments, and it was approved in 2006, and on page 9 of that Navy protocol, you'll see that the Navy is still funding, and I'm using their words, mind control, quote and unquote, mind control projects, but they have to be approved at the deputy director level primarily because or deputy secretary level of the Navy, rather, because of the nature of public outcry, along with experiments on prisoners and other things that people might find objectionable, you know, if you live in a civil society. And the sad story is, you know, these provisions, on the one hand, they claim, oh, we're not doing anything, and on the other, that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, Chris and Janet Morris, the way they came into contact with this technology is that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, the KGB sponsored a conference in Moscow, and at this conference, the purpose of it was to market some of their formerly top secret technology to the rest of the world. And Chris and Janet Morris were there and saw a demonstration of this. And by the way,
surprises me because you know it's really about that, and there's a lot of bidders for this type of technology. I can assure you, in terms of national governments.
Well, they the Soviets used this technology during their adventures into Afghanistan. And of course, I would just say, well, how'd that work out for you? You know, so maybe this technology is not all it's cracked up to be. But the next arms race
evolves over time, and I think that's the thing. Is you look at the Russians in the 80s and where we're today.
Yeah. Well, this Elena Rusilkina, who is the widow of Smirnov, predicts that the next arms race will be in psychotronic weapons. Now, that was in 2007
I think that race has actually been going on, and you can trace it back. In fact, we have documents that were declassified by they actually used to refer to it as paraphysics, and parapsychology was the other word often associated with this. But we have a number of the old Eastern Bloc, sort of our look at them, and which really reflect on us as well. But you can also look at some of the early work of Ostrander and Schroeder, their book Discovered Behind the Iron Curtain, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain from 1973, which documented a variety of projects. In fact, they've updated it a few years back. I know it's out there in used bookstores, but people should get hold of it. I mean, this stuff goes back, over 60, 70 years in terms of serious research, and where we are today in this area is much, much further along. And here's the thing about all the mind control issues that people miss in the debate, and the thing that I consider the most important aspect of it all. It wasn't so much about what they were discovering, but obviously was about these anomalous human capabilities, what we used to call extrasensory perceptions or ESP. They were also learning about manipulating behavior to get people to do things and manipulate what the outcomes would be, changing emotions, transferring words, that kind of thing. And most people focused on some of that, but when you look at it from another standpoint, what they also discovered were these latent capabilities that probably exist in every human being, what we used to call extrasensory perceptions. From my perspective, and if you look through virtually every tradition, religious and otherwise, and once, you know, religion and science kind of bound together, these expressions of human capacity, I think, scared the heck out of military planners, because fully actualized human beings have tremendous potentials, and from time to time throughout human history, we've run into a few of those. And the fact is, all of us are those. And that's what I think the big discovery has been, is what human beings truly are capable of. And at the same time, those that have a whole lot to hide fear that the most. Actualized populations for those kinds of forces become pretty destructive. And because once you know what's sort of happening behind the scenes and you get a better sense of it, your tolerance for it will be reduced. And here's the reality. The way you keep a population from ever reaching their higher states of consciousness or awareness is you have to keep them in a constant agitated state of underlying anxiety and fear. Because when you do, if you look in the EEG that measures brain activity of human beings, what you'll see is very incoherent, the flight or fight response kind of brain patterns. On the other hand, populations that are functioning under what we call higher emotions, love, compassion, empathy, tend to have more rhythmic patterns that are associated with higher order thinking, intellectual processes, and what it slows and pulses within certain ranges are associated with the paranormal kinds of experiences. But you cannot have any of that as long as you maintain living in an environment of fear, anxiety, and frustration.
All right, we have to step away for a break. When we come back, I want to get a little bit esoteric here with this technology. We shall return, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. My deepest sympathy for whatever kept you from the first hour, because you have missed literal universes of information. But you're here now, and we're glad you are. I said I was going to get a little bit esoteric in my question, so let me do it. We've talked about how changes in frequencies, oscillating pulsed frequencies and so forth, can change behavior. And you were talking about the way that you can keep a population from actualizing by using technology. And by actualizing, we mean coming into their own in terms of their what we call psychic abilities. And this is something you said that you think that as they did all this research, they found that everybody had these abilities, and it scared them because there can be no secrets when everyone has actualized those abilities. All right, now, here's the esoteric thing.
And I think that's exactly it. In fact, the military actually spent money on developing, a number of protocols for enhancing people's, for instance, their intuition, which is kind of the baseline or the door of entry. And when you start to trust your inner voice or conscience, whatever you want to call it, when you start to listen to it a little bit more, you find out that it's really tuned to something that is inexplicable. And we've all had those moments or those experiences where those things come into real clear focus. You can call them coincidence. We usually kind of blow them off that way. And as we do, we sort of shut down the volume. We eventually turn it off, because we ignore that information. And really, we should be integrating it, thinking about it a little bit more.
Did you hear that, folks? You hear it click? Well. Did you hear that? He got cut off. All right, we'll see if we can get him back. I wanted you to hear that. So we'll see if we can get him back. I don't know that we can, but we will try to get him back. We shall see. I think somebody doesn't want this esoteric question asked. Somebody doesn't want this information in your ears. What happened? We've got you, and I hope you can hear me. What happened?
Well, I don't hear anything. We'll hang up and you can try that.
Okay. Well, folks, that's one of the beauties of the fact that we do this show live. For some folks, all of this is frustrating. But for me, I want you to hear what's happening.
This is Nick.
All right, Dr. Nick, can you hear me?
I can hear you. You're in the background pretty faint, but I can hear you.
Somebody obviously didn't want us to talk about this.
It always seems that way when you're right in the middle of the main point. And the point I was making before we lost contact with you was this idea that, look around the country at the anti-anxiety drugs and just the whole depression, marketing market, and what it's yielded. Think about the advertisements that come at us every day that generate fear, whether it's about your bad breath and underarm deodorant or about your politics. The fact is, it comes at us in ever-increasing quantities and strips us of our ability to think clearly and act in the manner in which human beings were truly intended to act. And I think that's where the recognition of that on sort of the real natural outgrowth of how do you keep people moving. Think back on whether it's an Adolf Hitler trying to move a population by wearing them down first and then injecting them with fear, and then figuring out someone to blame for that so that that anger is rechanneled somewhere else. Boy, it sure sounds like what's happening today on so many fronts. You know, it doesn't take an Adolf Hitler to do it. It requires only the characterization of a story and the constant wearing down of a population by never-ending bad news. And the reality is, and I think that's, you know, we've lost sight of the possibilities, I think, in a lot of this. And we've been focused so much on the drama of events that we're not working our way out of them. And that's where our hope gets lost, and we continue to kind of fall into the spiral.
Okay, but I think something else is happening to us, too. I think there's something else happening, and that's what this esoteric question's about. Here it is. We hear, there's something, I believe it's called the Schumann frequency.
Right, Schumann's resonance, yeah.
Okay. And we hear that that has an effect upon our, not just our emotions, but our psychic abilities as well. Now we are approaching the passing through the galactic medium. And we're getting closer and closer to that. And I'm reading things on the internet that tell us that this Schumann's resonance is increasing. And so some people think, and they postulate, that we are becoming more actualized. We are becoming more aware, more actualized as a result of that. So the esoteric question, if that's happening to us, and if that's something that all these secret keepers really fear, then couldn't we expect them to turn up the volume on HARP and other things like it to combat that and to try and keep the populations electronically lobotomized?
Well, that's an interesting set of thoughts. Firstly, the idea of Schumann's resonance escalating or changing. You know, I heard this first. I think it was Greg Braden, roommate, was making this claim back in the 90s, and that it had risen to 13 hertz or something like this, up from 7.83. And UCLA at the time was actually monitoring Schumann's resonance every 15 minutes. And while there was some small variation, it never was that extreme. You know, and the fact is, it was still within the 7.83. Slightly above, slightly below range. And so when you start asking the question, you know, where did you get the information, I've not ever seen that quantified to support the statement that the frequency is increasing. So if someone has that information, I sure would like to see it. Because the last time I chased that down with the help of a radio listener who found that site at UCLA and then another companion site, you know, that pretty much refuted it. And when people make those claims, the first question should be, what's your source? And then the second piece of this is Schumann's resonance was discovered in Munich, Germany in the 1950s, around 53, I believe, or 54. And when it was discovered by Schumann, it was a new observation that the Earth had this pulse rate that correlated with the sort of the border region between alpha and theta as far as the correlation in the human mind, which happens to be a very creative state. This is where 3 to 5 year olds spend a lot of their time, and you think about all the knowledge they gain and how rapidly they gain it at that time. You know, this is the natural oscillation of the Earth. On the other hand, as you increase, if this were true, as you increase the oscillation, you lose touch with these higher abilities, because these higher abilities are based on a slower rhythm, not a faster rhythm.
So it would have the opposite effect.
The whole discussion runs counter to the logic of the science. It would be the other way around if it were truly the case. But definitely a change. Now, in terms of, you know, this kind of, I don't want to call it millennium thinking because it's you're calendaring it differently. But however we look at this sort of shift, some people refer to the Mayan calendar, the end of time, the beginning of the next age, all this stuff and all these correlations that come up, and some see it as disaster and some see it as liberation. Change is both, always. And so I think we're in for what on the outside might look to some to be disaster, but it is a time, I think, of transition and a time of awakening to higher potentials in that sense. And people are looking to sort of external sources for all that, to the next guru, whoever that guy is. And I got news for everyone. You're standing in the same shoes. You know, it's you. It's about each individual recognizing their birthright as a created human being and beginning to exercise what goes along with that. And we do it in steps, and we will evolve. And I think we're in a period of serious evolution, and it's expressed in our technologies in one sense. But that's an outward expression of somebody's internal thoughts, ultimately. There's a lot going on, and I think some very good things to counter sort of the dark side of some of these technologies.
What do you think accounts for the fact that there's a lot going on? Why are we in this incredible burst of evolution?
Well, you know, I think it's maybe a coalescing of a bunch of things. Part of it is the ability to, you know, when you think about at the same time we're talking about suppressed communications and monitored communications, think about the fact that we can even have the scale of communication that we can today. I mean, in 20 years, we have totally changed the way in which information is shared, transferred, and evolved to the point where information and its development of applied theory to applied technologies to things that actually impact us has moved from a century to months. You know, that kind of change is what's driving so much of that. And again, it's an expression of us. You know, we're the creative element in all that, human beings, human consciousness. I think that's pretty exciting. I think it's just, it parallels what we see expressed in the world we create around us, because we're the ones doing it on a fundamental level. And if you look at quantum physics, I mean, what does it teach us about human consciousness? It says that the human being, the observer, determines whether something is a particle or an energy wave. In other words, whether it's matter or energy, on a fundamental basis. Whoa! As the foundational building block for creation is consciousness, and you and I have a little fragment of that, a little reflection of that, maybe a little piece of a hologram of the entire creation in that, and that maybe is that which is the reflection of the idea of being created in the image of a creator. And I think that is, and I think the discovery of that as we move forward is what science is beginning to demonstrate. But the fear that goes with that for, you know, people who see that as a challenge to power structures, you know, it's going to create, you know, an unsettling time. And I think we're in that time today.
Well, you know that on this show I deal with the topics of UFOs and extraterrestrials, right, and ghosts and all kinds of things, anything that is strange and unexplained, and or futuristic science. Because futuristic science, for most of us, is strange and unexplained. And there are a great many things happening in science that seem to be coalescing with spirituality. And that's very, very hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. But it is beginning to happen.
It's going to happen increasingly so, because I think what also is happening is a lot of old guys with PhDs are dying of old age and aren't defending bad ideas anymore. And it's sort of the normal thing, and I'm laughing a little bit because it seems like every 50 years is what it takes, you know, and that's about the cycle time on someone's science career. And if you look at science and how it's evolved and how fast it's evolving, I think that there's a little bit less of that defensiveness and a little more willingness to step forward, and because the market is driving science on a certain level. You think about it, you know, whoever gets there first sort of wins the prize. So the idea of taking scientific theory and then getting it engineered into something meaningful that means something to someone, you know, some consumer out there, whether it's some government program or whether it's some individual. And I think that's, again, you know, you're talking earlier about, you know, sort of having the for sale on telepathy technology in Moscow, you know. Well, ultimately, you know, that's what does happen. It's just that the game has changed. The science is flatter, and you never know who's going to squirt out the next big breakthrough in terms of intelligence. And that's, again, a reflection of who each of us are, because it's never, or as often as it's not, It's the guy in the garage with no science background making the really incredible breakthrough, whether he's the Wright Brothers bicycle shop guy figured out how to make a heavier than aircraft work, or whether it's the inventor of Microsoft software with a bunch of guys hanging around the garage, or the first microcomputers for that matter. You know, the idea that somehow science is relegated to the academics is saying that creativity is relegated to somebody who's trained. Creativity is a reflection of each of us. We can learn an awful lot about how to channel that in unique ways. And that's, I think, our challenge as human beings on the planet today, individually and collectively. And, well, so the fear, the anxiety, all of that is, I think, equally countered by the possibility that is equally present, which is a possibility for real change.
I agree, but it appears to me that at the upper levels of information and at the upper levels of technology, it's all being manipulated, and here's why. We have one of the very famous scientists. Some people think he's a great scientist, some people don't, but he's very famous, and his name is Stephen Hawking. So Stephen Hawking comes out with his statement that we really, you know, there might be some extraterrestrials out there, but we really shouldn't be trying to contact them because we don't know what they're like, and you know, they obviously would have superior technology, and this could be really harmful to us. So here we have a very negative statement about contact with any extraterrestrial race, based on we don't know, therefore we should avoid. Okay, CERN, the CERN facility, the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
One of the big concerns that some physicists have expressed, and there have been lawsuits filed, and I think rejected, but still they were filed, to try and stop them from doing what they're doing. One of the big concerns is that the Large Hadron Collider may, in fact, generate what they call strangelets. And I think a lot of us would call those miniature black holes, but quantum strangelets. Okay. Now, if we accept, well, since we don't know, let's avoid, if we accept that from Stephen Hawking, why wouldn't we apply that to the Large Hadron Collider as well? Since we don't know, let's avoid. But you have these very bright physicists, scientists, who are stepping out and saying, oh, there's nothing to worry about. We don't think that's going to happen. Chances are one in a million. And, okay, so they've got, we're getting that message, which is, we don't know, so let's go see. But from Hawking's on the subject of extraterrestrials, we don't know, so let's avoid. And it seems to me that what we have is someone at the top, maybe several someones, manipulating this. They've got one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake.
Well, I think on some levels that may be true. You know, in terms of, you know, on the one hand, in every science advance, you know, you have the anxiety of, you know, what are we doing? At the same time, you've got a lack of a multidisciplinary approach. You know, when Harper started, the guys that started that saw it as a plasma lab in the sky. You know, that's how they viewed it. You know, others considered that, you know, a little risky adventure to be, you know, going out on. And so I think caution in all these things is prudent, but at the same time, the recognition of, you know, is Hawking suggesting that, oh, if we send out the flare, maybe we'll attract the pirates, you know, is what it sounds like to me, and maybe that's the case. You know, I would hope not. I mean, if and when those things all occur and we start to find out what all this stuff is that's been reported over the years, you know, it's certainly going to change our perception of who we are in the universe and who we are, you know, in creation itself. I don't think it diminishes us in any way, and I certainly wouldn't be one to stand up and limit God's creative capacity and what that entails. But I would say this, that, again, not to succumb to fear. You know, Reagan and Kissinger and others suggested that, you know, one of the ways to unite the planet was on an external threat. You know, are we being you know, pre-registered to look for that possibility? You know, is that what's going to bring us under the thumb of some new authoritarian source that'll have a global governance structure?
Well, you know, that is being talked. That's being talked a lot on the internet.
Yeah, well, that's been in motion for a long time. You know, when you think about United Nations activity and what that entails, and I don't know anybody in the United Nations that I voted for, and I don't think anybody voted for anyone in the United Nations, and yet they drive a whole lot of international policy. And I find that type of representation repugnant because it doesn't represent me, and I didn't have a voice in saying who's there. I think when we look at global governance cross-culturally, it's impossible at this state in our evolution unless there were some significant external threat that united us, and whether or not that threat was real or created. And I think that's, again, where we need to be consciously aware as human beings. And I don't think on a certain level that this planet is prepared to unite around any theme. And I think if you look around the world, the idea of some external source would probably cause revolution in some places and complacency in others. And so what does that unity really end up looking like? Who knows? I can't see the Muslim world yielding to a, you know, to an external force of any kind. You know, I mean, you start to think about how does that butt up against people's fundamental religious beliefs, whatever they might be. There's a lot of challenges in all of that, whether it's real or whether it's a created illusion. Because much of the UFO activity that has been reported over time turns out, not all, but a good portion turns out to be our own or other military experimental aircraft. And some of this stuff, I think, is our own still to this day. And some of it, of course, does defy explanation. And, you know, one of these days, maybe we'll get to the truth. Maybe sooner than later, the way things are starting to break.
What concerns me doing this show and the kind of topics that we deal with, we put everything that we've learned about UFOs and extraterrestrial civilizations, the possibility of them, we put all that together with everything that we know about the extreme high technology. At least from our point of view, it looks like extreme high technology. Perhaps not from an extraterrestrial's point of view, but from our point of view, it looks like extreme high technology. You put it all together, and it looks like a very real possibility. I'm not going to say a probability, but at least a possibility that this extreme high technology could be used to generate this false flag operation that people are talking about, to make us think that we are under attack by extraterrestrials, or that we're under threat by extraterrestrials. And while this may sound far-fetched to some folks who are listening to us, they need to just stop and think about, in the past 12 months, where things have progressed on this topic of extraterrestrials. The Vatican's talking about baptizing them. The United Nations has appointed an ambassador to them. You know, we're getting ready for something here. We have to take a break. We'll be back, and hopefully nobody will cut off Dr. Begich on the telephone. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dr. Nick Begich. And as we went to break, I was just pointing out, look how far we've come in 12 months on this issue of extraterrestrials. And you know, the Vatican's talking about baptizing them. The UN has appointed an ambassador to them. Stephen Hawking has sort of admitted that, yeah, there probably are some extraterrestrials out there. We've got NASA telling us they've discovered another Earth that's habitable. And it's relatively close. It's in our neighborhood out here in the universe. And, I mean, you add all of this up, and, you know, we're getting messages, lots and lots of messages about extraterrestrials might be a threat to us. You couple that with the kinds of technology that we've been talking about this evening, and it doesn't really look like an inviting prospect.
Well, it's certainly the temptation, you know, and that's, again, you go back to some of the writings, you know, along this line in terms of technologies and the use of technologies. And Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote the book Between Two Ages, and it was a book written in the early 70s when he was at Columbia University, and he was really looking at the impact of technologies looking forward. And, you know, what he said essentially was the idea that, you know, whether it was conservative or liberal, the temptation to use technology to further political ends on the idea that, you know, they believe, you know, obviously, you know, whoever's in power actually does believe what they're saying is right, to further whatever they believe the version of the truth is. And, you know, they thought from the standpoint of conservatives, it was their fascination with gadgetry and, you know, new technologies. And in terms of liberals, the idea of furthering, you know, political ends. And, you know, when you look at all of it, the end result is the same, is the idea that technology should serve political purposes in this way is fundamentally wrong. Technology, in terms of the effect on human consciousness, at least, ought to be one of the most restricted areas of any form of experimentation, particularly military applications. I mean, we limit poisonous gas, and we limit blinding lasers, but nobody has gotten to the point of eliminating from the scene the potential of weapons of this sort we've been talking about. And yet both sides acknowledge research in this area and expenditures in this area, continuing advances in the area, without any regulation. And that's the problem, is our technologies now are advancing so rapidly that the kind of public debate that's necessary is not happening. I mean, the technologies are already evolved, being used, and deployed before we have a chance to even weigh in on them. And that's where we are on so much of this, and particularly that which has been classified for decades. We get little snippets here and there, and then as you start to look at the research. And now what's happening is, once it gets kind of overwhelming, where your ability to deny things has kind of gone away, like what we're seeing, and maybe the same with UFO phenomena, and the disclosures are coming now. Maybe it's because it's gotten to the point where, you know, you can't keep lying when other countries are starting to tell the truth. And so, or at least tell what they observe, whatever mm-hmm. that truth might represent. And whether it's, you know, what is it, where does it come from, what do the observations mean, maybe the jury's out on a full understanding of all of it. But at least we're starting to see some discussion. And I think that's, again, in these other areas, as the science advances and starts to cross a lot of thresholds, we have the opportunity to talk about it. And I think that's the challenge today. And one of the roles that I've at least tried to play on some of this technology in the last 15 years is to try and at least get the evidence in front of people in a documented way and in plain English, so we can at least have this kind of discussion and hopefully eventually see it translate into the appropriate kind of regulation, restriction, and penalties for those that violate ultimately freedom of the mind.
Because of your research and your writing for these many years on this high technology, you probably are more aware of the true state of our technology than probably 99% of the rest of the civilian population. Now, with what you know about the state of our technology, if there really was a threat from an alien civilization, people who could travel light years to get here, if there really was a threat, with all of this technology that we think is high technology, would it be sufficient to defend against that threat?
Well, this is interesting. I think what's in the public domain, the answer would be no, because anyone who could arrive here from wherever they're coming from are way ahead of at least what the public recognizes as the state of our science. I think we're probably, you know, a couple of leaps ahead of where the public is for sure in terms of what's really out there. And just given what I know about the directions of the research and the directions DARPA's taken over the last few decades, I don't think we're ready to defend ourselves from such a threat completely, but we're certainly gaining some capacity in this area. And I think that, again, is, what is the threat, and what does it mean in the long run, and is it really a threat at all? All of this is a bit confusing, and I think it creates, the lack of knowledge creates kind of anxiety and fear that, when in doubt, close the door. And I think that's where we are right now. And if, in fact, the stories are true and the history is true, and there's others that have researched this much more than I, and I know many of them in the UFO line, and they've done some credible work in this area. And that work indicates maybe this goes back centuries, and, so far we're still here and breathing. At least we haven't felt like we're rats in a big experiment. I don't know. But the reality is, who knows? And the uncertainty of life is such as that, and whether it's a threat from outside or a threat from inside, we need to let go of threats and start evolving ourselves and recognize that there is more to who we are. And these sort of transit states of fear generated by the unknown, hey, if there really is life and consciousness out there, let's just hope it has evolved a little further than a lot of us. And if that's the case, maybe we'll have a more pleasant dialogue than a conflict. But who knows?
Well, I fully agree with that. I totally agree with that. Let me give you a technological reason why I think the idea of a threat from extraterrestrials is bogus. The U.S. Air Force proposed, they put a paper together where they proposed short-term or near-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And one of their short-term goals was to have this space-based space surveillance system, a fleet of satellites, deployed by the end of 2010. And part of their purpose was, and I'm quoting the article that I got this information from, and this article was either in Space Daily or Space.com. I can't remember which one of those. But it said that part of its purpose would be to identify and track deep space forces for both offensive and defensive purposes. Offensive and defensive operations. And I asked the question here on the air, deep space forces? Who's coming? Okay. Now, here we are at the end of 2010. They fell far behind their schedule because of problems with the rocket that was to deliver the first of these satellites into space. They fell far behind, 3 years behind, and we've just, in September, launched the first of this fleet of satellites. If there was really a threat, there would not have been a 3-year delay.
Wow. Now that's interesting. In some of this, what surprises me, about a lot of this is if you look, like you say, you read an article and you see these little bits, and they're like, well, wait a minute, what did they just say? Deep space threats. What does that mean? And then you find later they'll issue the qualifier. Oh, what we were talking about is asteroids and comets and a way to knock them out. This is a deep space threat.
Yeah, but this article used the word deep space forces.
Yeah, which is a big difference. And again, all of this, all of these little bits coming out right now, are they to say to the world, so when the day comes, hey, at least the panic won't be quite as severe? I don't know. The majority of people, I think, in polling that's been done in recent years believe in, you know, life out off of this planet, and that it, perhaps it can come and visit us someday, or maybe it already has. And I think that, again, is very different than, say, 50 years ago, where that certainly wouldn't have been the prevailing belief of most people in civilized countries. So, you know, that whole attitude has shifted. And like you say, the information coming out now, which starts to lend even more credibility, where the expectation, I think it's now more of an expectation, you know, not if, but when. And so, you know, I think our mindset has tremendously altered just even in the last 30, 40 years particularly. And then you see, as you say, the things coming out of the Vatican, coming out of the UN, the recent number of folks that came forward from the military that, you know, spoke openly about, you know, obscure observations and in their experience in UFOs.
Yeah, and look how the press treated it. The press treated it like real news. That's another big change within these last 12 months.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, this, it's not ridiculed or marginalized anymore, and that, I think, is an important step. You know, it's the... You know, it is always the case, you know, and change, and that's why change is so difficult to see manifest, because usually it's ridiculed, and then eventually, you know, it's proven, and eventually it's common knowledge, you know, and I think that's where we are in a lot of the science. And we just don't have the time anymore. We don't have decades to evolve our thinking. When we think about the type of technologies that can impact every aspect of our life so profoundly, and are we going to let, you know, some group of small group of think tank intelligence folks make decisions and about shaping what humanity looks like? I don't think that's the right approach. I think it's a flatter approach, which means that each of us has to take a little bit more responsibility about, you know, sort of what happens around us. It doesn't mean we all have to know, you know, all of the ins and outs of science any more than we know how to fix a modern automobile, but we can still drive it, and we can still drive the direction in which our science and our public dollars particularly go. And, you know, I think it's the big challenge. You know, the challenge for this nation, for the world, is this crossroads of technology, and whether it enslaves us or truly liberates us to our higher and better potentials. And that's, I'll tell you, you know, the last 15 years I've spent reporting on sort of the dark side of what's going on, and we've shifted a lot of our focus in the last couple of years to working on some things that can turn that another direction. And I think the science that's coming has the potential of adding to that, making greater possibilities. I think as we discover these things for sort of manipulating people, we also discover things about people that maybe we can enhance. You know, you exercise the body, maybe this century will be the one where we learn to exercise the mind and its link to consciousness itself.
Well, I think probably the most important science in this millennium, even this century, I think probably the most important science is going to be the science of consciousness. You know, that's not woo-woo. That is real fertile area for science. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Nick Begich, and we're on Final Approach. Just a few minutes left. You know, when we went to break, Dr. Begich, I made the statement that I think the really fertile soil for scientific investigation and scientific research and advancement in this century and this millennium will be in the fields of consciousness, and I don't think that's woo-woo. Consciousness is a reality, and it's a reality about which we know very little.
I think that's exactly right. And at the same time, you know, it's I give you a simple thing that pops up all the time. You know, you look at the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hear about the placebo effect. And when you really stop and think about what is that, that's where the mind duplicates whatever the healing mechanism was supposed to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you got healed, the placebo effect. What does that really mean? You know, you stop and think about it for a bit. It's the power of the consciousness to do, because all of a sudden you believe you're getting the medication that's going to make you well, and now you're well. Boy, that's interesting. You know, we always think about it as some excuse for why things don't work out statistically, instead of acknowledging, hey, maybe this is the working out in terms of the better alternative. Is it has more to do with what you believe and what you anchor as truthful, and then how your consciousness translates that into reality. And fundamentally, that's really the way it works. You know, when you whether you look at the quantum physics of the particle wave equation, you know, or some of the more advanced thinking as it's being evolved, you know, in terms of what is consciousness and what is a human mind capable of. And that's, to me, that's the exciting stuff. And that's why we should all be greatly encouraged. And I think that's the thing. And it's not, you know, there's a whole lot of independent thinkers and researchers, and just like the guys of the last century, coming out of the most obscure places with the greatest breakthroughs, I think the same will happen in this century in the areas that we're talking about, because that's the way creativity and consciousness functions in the real world. And you can create institutions to try and control a lot, but ultimately you can't control that, and that's pretty exciting. And the world is a big place. There's a lot of minds out there working in a lot of diverse places. And this can come from anywhere. And usually what happens is when good ideas are ready to come on the planet, usually three or four people or groups of people end up bringing them forward. You know, there's kind of a fight to the patent office, you know, who did it first. And I think we're going to see the same kinds of things and the same kind of excitement as our areas of advanced technologies move forward, especially in the area of consciousness and the mind and its linkage to consciousness. And perhaps,
do you see,
you know, a lot of this is the health sciences, I mean, the related fields. It's going to be a pretty incredible century if we can just get through, you know, the birth pains of the beginning a decade or two.
Do you see a possible dichotomy or separation or segregation of population based on some who want to go with the using technology for bizarre and perhaps what many of us would consider dark purposes, and those who want to use technology but want to use it for more positive and productive purposes? Is there a possibility of sort of a separation of population over that?
You know, when you get right down to it, haven't we just always done that? You know, whether it was you know, the machete to clear the field, and then the machete to cut off your adversary's head. You know, it depends on the
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is an actual physical separation, where the world divides into the two camps.
Yeah, I think that's here too, and I think we're seeing it start to emerge on a lot of different levels. And you know, in terms of a clear, stark division, do I see that as an eventual outcome? Yeah, perhaps so. I think that it's going to be a question of those that want to maintain power and the status quo, which is essentially corrupt, because what's allowed to be done in secret tends to not work in favor of populations. And so, you know, those in power have the most to lose, and consequently, you know, if you want to call it dark or light, it's the loser in the equation, because mm-hmm. people will become aware of the injustices that have been done, not just by those that we consider unjust on its face, but even those governments we've believed were just. We're going to find a lot of dark places that we don't like to have to deal with. And our country is not going to be exempt from that. We're going to be one of the leaders in it. We've interfered with governments around the world for decades. We've had an ability to manipulate and persuade that periodically is revealed to the public when everyone's dead. This time around, I think we need openness. We need a truth commission like what South Africa went through, where people can come forward, tell the truth in the public interest, and be pardoned, and at the same time, within a reasonable frame, if they don't come forward, they ought to be penalized. And we need to have that kind of thing happen on some level in this country and every other country of the world, because it's time to hold people accountable for the things they've done against humanity, and at the same time to demonstrate the higher attributes of human beings, which is the ability to forgive and overcome those challenges once the truth is laid bare. And I think that's where we're at, and hopefully we can pass through that kind of reconciliation, as opposed to something that many people around the world are predicting, which is a violent reconciliation of sort of the old with what hopefully will become the new.
Well, I hope it takes the track that you've just described. I sincerely hope it takes that track. However, the power paradigm is in its death spasms now. And many creatures of this planet become far more dangerous when they're in their death spasms. And
I agree with you.
So, you know, I think it's a time to walk softly and carry a big stick.
I agree with you on that count as well. You know, it is human nature, and it's going to be an interesting period. I'm excited by it, in both the, you know, the dark side and the bright side. I think we'll get through it as humans have. And we're not doing it alone. You know, there's people are waiting for some organization to form, and the final message of the evening is it's already here. It's called the human race, and each of us stand in it, whether we understand it completely and our full participation in it. We're as equal a leader as the next guy. You know, there are no small things. Each thing we do matters in the long run. We just need to do something in favor of what we believe is right and true, and do it with the right spirit in mind, and I think we can make things change. There's millions of people on this planet today attempting that every day, and I think that's the answer, and each of us has our spheres of influence, and it's amazing what all that can coalesce into, and I think that's the message, and perhaps a better message than one that leaves people in a state of fear and panic. We don't need that. We need to start recognizing those things that cause that, and then figuring out the way through it, because that is the challenge of this generation, is to find our way through it.
I fully agree with that. Dr. Begich, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. We've run out of time. It's been absolutely fascinating, as I knew it would be. And again, thank you for giving us your time this evening.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's always my pleasure, and we'll have to do it again sooner than later.
Okay, very quickly, tell us again your website.
Sure. The website is EarthPulse, EARTHPULSE, EarthPulse.com, and that'll plug you into all of our data. Lots of good material there that's free, and our books and publication, which help us continue to do this work. And so we just thank you for the time, and we just wish your listening audience well this evening, and a great weekend to everyone out there.
Outstanding. If you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment as I bring tonight's show to a close. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Nick Begich. Don't forget, if you haven't subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, do it now. My friends call me Steely, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.